The following is a conversation between Mike Nitter and Fred Vobey, recorded on September 1, 1991, during the 1991 National Radio Club Convention in Bridgeport, West Virginia. Well, it is September 1, 1991, and yet another convention, and sitting with me right now is Mike Nitter from headquarters. So, Mike, tell me, how's this convention been so far?
Well, very good, Fred, and glad to see that we've got such a good-sized turnout here. A lot of DX Audio Service people are represented here, which is always nice to have. And basically, as well, I'm sure you'll hear later on in this tape or in future tapes, the business meeting discussion about inputs and stuff, and I've had a chance to go around and talk to a lot of them, and it's been very well received convention. Everybody seems to be enjoying themselves, and for those that didn't make it, you missed a good time.
Let me ask you some questions about the NRC itself. We always advertise the world's largest and oldest medium wave club. How is DXing these days stacking up? Is it still a good, viable hobby for everyone?
Oh, I think it is. Just like 10 years ago when people said that there's no DX out there, I think if you look over the last 10 years, it's becoming more of a challenge, obviously, but I think we've got better equipment nowadays. We've got the loop antennas. I think we've got people with more knowledge of their equipment, which I think helps. And I think, really, it's getting to be more of a challenge, which I think is more fun. And I'm sure 10 years from now we're going to look back and say, boy, these guys had it easy back in 91. So I think it's still there. I think the flavor of the hobby is still out there, and it's basically what you make of it.
Let me ask you what the NRC is looking to do in the future. What is future plans for the National Radio Club? What kind of things you think will change due to the you know, the differences in economy, the 90s, technology? What's on the horizon?
Oh, that's a weighted question. Well, like, as the NRC has evolved since the 30s with the paper side of the house, I'm sure we're going to do and see a lot of changes coming up with the, with the audio service, obviously. As was discussed in a lot of the meetings here, we're going to see more and more changes. More and more programs become available on the audio side of the house. More cassettes available, more special offers, more products. And as we gear up for that over the next two or three years, I think you'll see more and more changes done. Of course, the inputs from the membership is always a big thing. We got to have their feedback, and I can't stress that enough times, that we have to have the feedback in order to get people to, they got to tell us what they want, because otherwise we're going to assume that what we're giving them is what's worth the our time and energy. So that's about the main thing. The other thing that really needs to be changed is, again, from the subscribers out there, they've got to let us know what they would like to see in the future. So it's something that they need to think about as they're listening to this tape.
A very unbiased question here I'm going to ask you now. How does the National Radio Club stack up with some of the other clubs? We've seen a few of them fold. Some of them are even like on the teetering point right now. How is the National Radio Club? How solid of a base do we have?
Well, I would compare us to the old insurance commercial, the Prudential, solid as the Rock of Gibraltar. We'll be getting, as the audio service people will probably be able to tell, those with sensitive ears, as we get new equipment and changes on that end, obviously that takes money and resources. And as we develop our product line, obviously that takes a lot of money. And the club, I think, is doing quite well. Stacked up against others, I would say we're doing, if you were to give it at least an unbiased opinion from me, I'd have to give the club an A-plus rating. We're expanding. We're getting more and more inquiries, again, due to the subscribership out there, talking to people that haven't heard the tapes. The more, obviously, they get out and talk to people, the more people show interest, the more they write to us and ask for a sample copy, and things work out pretty good. The other thing, I think, is that we're always... we've never gone in the negative side of the house for subscribership. We've always either broke even or have gone ahead. And unlike other clubs, we basically are sitting in a stable condition or they're in a decline for membership. So I think we're sitting very good as far as subscribership goes. Product line, as I said before, over the next two or three years, you're going to see that increase. And obviously, we can't do that unless we had the base to work off of.
Okay, you mentioned about subscribers and members in the club. How does the National Radio Club stack up against the other clubs as far as number of members? I get the feeling, due to the number of members that we have, that it is probably one of the more important clubs around. Is that a true statement?
Yes, it is. Because we deal with the EM and FM dial, which is everybody listens to it versus the shortwave, it's a very important hobby. And as we get into the other aspect of the FM more, as the club kind of steers in that direction, as we steer more toward the listenership versus the actual technical DXer, and we get the average Joe on the street to subscribe to the DX audio service and the DX News magazine. As far as stacking up to the other organizations, I think you're going to see that the National Radio Club, we have a tendency to listen more to our subscribership and bend in the direction of what they give us for suggestions. So your suggestion out there doesn't go unheeded. We do take every suggestion, no matter how off the wall it is. What may start out as an off-the-wall type statement or inquiry from you, we may look at it in a different light, bend it a little bit, and who knows, down the road you may see it on the tapes. A good example is the market scope. Look at the changes. You know, a lot of people said, hey, we wanted to include more stuff on more stations, or at least mention them, and we did that with no problem. Some of the features you guys wanted shortened, we shortened them up. Some of them you guys wanted more and longer the feature extended, and we've done that. So it's, of course, you got to keep in mind that we've only got 90 minutes on a tape, so it's hard to get 180 minutes on one, but we do try to, go with the flow of things. So.
Okay, let me ask you one final question here, and that concerns like the publication side of the house and some of the things that we have available. You mentioned now that I guess if you're a New York State resident purchasing from the Publication Center in New York, that you have to pay sales tax, and now if you're a Wisconsin resident and you're buying through the credit card, you have to pay. Give us a lowdown on all this, because I know it's quite confusing.
Yes, it is. It's basically the reason for all that is that we've got, because we have two Publication Center outlets, we have three now, I'll get into that in a little bit. We have the two, one in New York and one in Wisconsin. And as anybody knows, when you buy something in your local area, you have to pay your local tax. So what we've done is to try to clarify it, and by that, if you're in Wisconsin and you buy from the Wisconsin outlet, in other words, through your credit card, since we only take credit cards in Wisconsin, you have to pay the Wisconsin tax. If you have a credit card and you're from any other state and you go through Wisconsin, there is no tax. If you're in New York and you live in New York and you send check or money order to the New York address, you have to pay the New York tax. And again, other states that send money orders or checks or whatever to the New York address do not have to pay the New York tax. And then, of course, again, when you think about it, if you're a New York person, it'd be better off to use your Visa or MasterCard to go through the Wisconsin outlet. You don't have to pay your tax in New York then. And for Wisconsin people, it would be best for them to use a check or money order and send it to New York, and you don't have to pay the Wisconsin tax. That's about the, it's a complicated, cloudy, foggy mess, but that's the way the state regulatory systems are set up. So.
I was going to say, after all that explanation, I was waiting for the little bunny to come through beating his drum or something.
Yeah, really.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for talking with us, Mike.
It's been a pleasure.
Any words of wisdom for until the next convention?
Well, you ought to attend. You missed out on this one. I would try to make it out to. We're going to be out in the Des Moines area, it looks like, Des Moines, Iowa. So if you can make it, start saving your pennies and nickels now, and by next year, I'm sure you can get there. For those that want to know what the convention's like, get a hold of Mike Lance and some of the other DX Audio Service people that are here, and you'll have yourself a good time, I'm sure.
I also had a chance to speak with John Bowker. Well, right now I'm talking with John Bowker, the man in the mobile home. our wandering gypsy.
I'm delighted to be out of the mobile home just for a few minutes.
So tell me, John, what have you thought about this year's convention?
Oh, terrific. Just overwhelming. I think Bill Swiger really deserves it, and his wife, too, Brenda. Where's she? She's right over there in the corner, and they have put together quite a show, and I understand it's going on this afternoon with long wire antennas. You're going to be involved, and last night was a lot of fun. And it was great to see Sue Nitter again, too, our illustrious auctioneer. She brings spirit to the meeting. I have to say that, yeah.
And I have to admit, she spirited my daughter there. You know, we're a couple bucks short this year because of that. Let me ask you a couple questions about DXing and such, radio in general. Where do you see the hobby going? You know, you gave us a nice talk yesterday about DAB.
Yeah,
what do you think is going to happen?
Well, first of all, DAB is a long time off, I mean, number of years. And after DAB, this digital audio broadcast, they call it digital radio, too, I see in some of the press releases now, DRB. Anyway, even after it arrives, there's going to be a long period. You know, KDKA is not going to go off the air the day DAB arrives. So there's going to be a long switchover period. And I'll be a little facetious, as AM dies, you know, in the next decade, perhaps, it's going to make for some terrific DXing opportunities. So I say that regrettably, but still. As far as DXing generally, I think this has been an outstanding year, at least in New Jersey, where we were up until the end of May before we moved out of there. We had some wonderful openings. It was just as quiet on the band as anything this winter, even though the winter was abnormally warm. I can't explain that, but...
In your travels going around the motorhome, you've had a chance to listen to a lot of radio. What do you see out there as far as what is happening with radio stations and what the sound is? And let's face it, this year was economically depressed. And, you know, a lot of stations had to do some clever things. What's going on out there?
You know, Fred, it's interesting you say that. That a lot of depression and stuff like that, or recession, excuse me. You don't say depression, do you? The... things that we have observed are that, one, the clarity of the stations, the audio sound quality, seems to be better than like a couple of years ago. It used to be that so many of the pre-recorded programs, they were muffled, they were noisy, there was hum on the signal, and a lot of that has disappeared. Even on the two stations in the Trenton market where I was very familiar, they cleaned up their act in the past 12 months, and they sound terrific now. The other thing I notice is the brightness of the announcing of the logos, of the jingle packages, of whatever, the slogans, are all very upbeat. Now, we came through Cumberland, Maryland, and down through Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. These are not areas that are witnessing a tremendous economic growth at this time, and I say that with... it's more than true, and yet the stations there are they're a happy sound. They are a positive and optimistic kind of outlook on these stations, and I love it. I think it's just terrific. I don't know if there's any political message there or not, but so far we've enjoyed it. On the negative side, we find more and more AM stations not being ID'd whatsoever. They're being simulcast with the FM, and it's always, you know, Q105. They never mention the AM side whatsoever. And, but I'd say generally I'm happy with what I'm hearing.
The radio markets that you've gone in, have you noticed any that you have been in, say, 10 years ago or more? Have you noticed any major changes in the way stations are conducting themselves and how they sound now?
Well, yeah, I would say, let's see, in the last 10 years, the markets I've been in are primarily the Trenton, Princeton, New Jersey, Eastern Pennsylvania markets. There are exceptions. They are recognizing that there is a buck to be made, I guess. They are more competitive. They are... I'll give you another hint. For years, I've been spending weekends on various stations. These include WHWH in Princeton, WIBG in Ewing, New Jersey, WBUD in Trenton. I even spent 4 years weekends on an FM station, just filling in. This was not what was putting bread and butter on my table, fortunately. In each case, the stations are getting more and more selective and demanding of their staff. When I first joined WBUD, they showed me how the controls worked and said, there to go to it. And I thought to myself, this could be a schlock operation. I mean, how do they know? They don't know me from nothing. When I came back to WBUD in 1990, spring of 1990, there were interviews. They went over the board with me. They gave me a sample air test and all that. It was, I was impressed. Because I passed. If I had not passed, I would have said, you know, terrible. But no, seriously. I think I was very happily impressed with what they were doing.
Okay, quick question about some history and stuff. You've been in broadcasting several years, I guess is a good, true statement.
Yeah.
Well, tell me something about
Yeah.
But tell me a little bit about, you know, some of the past past things that you've done, like KNBR and such.
Let me go back to, excuse me, Fred. Let me go back to 1947, which was my first summer. It was a summer job. I don't remember if they paid me or not. On WCAX in Burlington, Vermont, I did Turntable Terrace. And the thing that people don't recall is that our instructions were, first of all, we had nothing but 78 RPM and two turntables, great big Gates turntables. And we did have transcriptions. Those are the 16-inch, 33 and a third, but we didn't use those for the Turntable Terrace music. We just played the top 40, you know, Frank Sinatra, Joe Stafford, and all that good stuff. We would introduce the record. We would say something. We had to say something not about music, not about the station, but something about Burlington or the area around us between each record. Not more than a minute. Something informative. Then we would play this latest release from Nat King Cole or something on Capitol Wax. I mean, they used words like wax and discs and stuff like that. And it was perfectly normal. But partway through the song, when Nat King Cole would stop singing and start playing the piano, and Sinatra would let Axel Stordahl do a break, you read a 30-second commercial. You never played a record without interrupting it for a commercial.
Really?
Not, well, I say never. Never's a long time. For the most part, our commercials were never read without a musical background.
That's interesting. And how did that... eventually, I guess they got out of that. I mean,
I think we both witnessed that. Yeah, it would be a terrible thing to interrupt a record now for a commercial. Oh, my goodness sakes.
I've never heard a Madonna record interrupted in I don't know how long. Tell us a little bit about NBC's KNBR.
That was an experience, and I have to be a little bit careful how I tell you this, but on April 1st, 1976, the engineering union called NABET on the West Coast, actually all over the country, struck against the National Broadcasting Company. And there was a big debate, you know, do I really want to go out and take somebody else's job? And it was pointed out that, John, don't give it a second thought. This is the way the game is played. And anyway, they took all the RCA directors and above, I would happen to be one of those, that had a first-class radio license. You still needed them in 1976. And three of us ran KNBR and the sister FM station, KNAI, FM 100 in San Francisco, for the period from then until May 24th. In fact, I got on the air on both stations, but mostly on KNAI, because I was the only one who could say the call letters and the city in the five-second window that the NBC News and Information Service allowed. Now, KNAI stood for News and Information. That's where the call sign came from. And the NBC, perhaps some of your subscribers recall, that NBC had a 24-hour all-news service called News and Information Service. And some of the jingles and the logos we've used here on the DX Audio Service over the years. But the idea of being able to say KNAI, FM 100 in San Francisco, in 5 seconds, I could do it. But the other two guys kept coming out, KNAI, San Francisco. They couldn't say KNAI. They couldn't say it. So I got to do all the IDs on KNAI for that 6-week period. That was fun. And then Saturday nights, on 4 occasions, I did a midnight to 6 a.m. disc jockey show on KNBR. That was all pretty much pre-packaged music. You were told what songs to play, what commercials to say. The only thing you weren't told was what to say other than the commercials and introducing the songs. You were limited, though, because you had something, it's been a long time, Fred, like 23 minutes of music, and 4 minutes of commercials. And so you only had 3 minutes during the 30 minutes to say anything. You had to be a little bit careful. You didn't start to enjoy your own voice too much. But getting phone calls from Mexico and Alaska and Wyoming, it was a kick, because 680 really reaches out. It's a non-directional signal out of just south of the airport is their big tower.
It's non-directional night?
Oh, yes. It's non-directional day and night and 50 kilowatts. Yeah. Yeah, which is remarkable for a Class 1B channel. But, yeah, they really, really put out a booming signal.
What about on the East Coast, other than WHWH and some of the other stations you've worked for, did you ever have any chance to work at 66 in the AM dial or do anything with them?
The closest I came to 66 on the AM dial in New York, I'm trusting you're asking, not Corpus Christi. Yeah, okay. No, and WNBC and all that. I don't recall my voice ever being heard on 660. I don't think it ever happened. I was on the Today Show once. I collect newspapers, historic headlines on newspapers. But I was on for 90 seconds during the 5 minutes when most of the stations break away for local news. But by golly, I was there. That was the Dave Garraway days. And that was a lot. That's as close. And the FM station, 97.1 in New York, which was NBC's, I was never on that. Fred, I'm a disappointment, I'm sure. I was on one with the good guys on WMCA once, but that was totally irrelevant. Yeah.
Let me get into some recent past. I'm very impressed by the amount of knowledge that you have in broadcasting and what you've done with RCA and NBC. What exactly did you do with this company? It seems like it's more like a legal fashion more than engineering. Is that a fair statement?
If you were a lawyer, you'd think of me as an engineer. The engineers at NBC thought of me as a lawyer. I was neither. Well, I am. I have a bachelor's degree in engineering physics. I guess if that makes me an engineer, I'm an engineer. But I had no legal training whatsoever. The job, Fred, was to direct the operation called the Frequency Bureau, which had been established by RCA in 1934 at the time the FCC was set up, to keep an eye on what the FCC was doing to be sure that NBC was and RCA both were getting, you know, like their fair shake. It started in Washington, and then it occurred to people, heck, in Washington we only need a couple of people. We need people in each of the major centers in Camden, New Jersey, New York City, and Indianapolis, Indiana. And so we had these offices all over of people who would sit down with the planning people at NBC and RCA at each of its owned stations and find out, what are your needs? And they'd say, well, we need a new STL link. We need a new remote pickup. Our IFB doesn't work. We need wireless microphones. We're going to relocate our transmitter. Any of these things, like WMAQ, moved its studio complex from the Merchandise Mart 2 years ago now to the new NBC Towers building in Chicago. That was two people for an entire year in my operation, doing layouts and plots and heights above sea level, and then going through the FCC to make sure that all of the microwave interconnects would not cause interference to, you know, WBBM and the others in the town. And it was a real tightrope walk to do that. My group would work with the engineers, not to decide that we need 5.2 watts in a 4-foot dish. The engineers at each station would do that. But what we would do is then plot out to verify what they come up with, then determine the azimuths, the heights above sea level, all the FCC type stuff. We'd file it with the FCC and then work with the FCC engineers when they would come up and say, you know, according to our charts, those curves overlap and they can't, that's forbidden. And what we would do is say, all right, go from 5.2 to 5.1 watts. And we would do this with the FCC. But it's you have to love the work, and then it's just there's no job like it. Otherwise, it's very tedious.
Do you find that with what you did with RCA and NBC, does a typical station out there have basically the same type of operation, or is this only the big boys are doing this kind of engineering and legal activity?
Oh, no. I would say for the most part, the TV stations around the country don't have this kind of a facility. What they will do is have a consulting engineering firm in Washington, and they're probably paying them way too much, and a consulting legal firm in Washington, and I know they're paying them way too much, because you don't need to be a lawyer to work with the FCC. In fact, the FCC people would grin and take me ahead of a lawyer sometimes, because they say, "Oh, come on in, John. She's like a breath of fresh air. I don't have to watch every word." Little did they know, they did have to watch every word. But no. Most of the stations will, when they want to make a change, which sometimes is quite rare because there's money involved, as you know very well, Fred, they will go to a consulting engineering firm and have it done.
Okay, last question, and big tough one. What is John Bowker going to be doing these days? Now that you're out of broadcasting and you got that motorhome, Jerry kids around with you a lot about the traveling gypsy. So what are you going to be doing?
I'm going to be working for the DX Audio Service full-time, Fred, because you can't beat the perks and the pay and everything else. And working with people like you and Mike Well, no, I've told enough lies at one time.
Thanks very much, John.
Delighted to be here, Fred. Take care.
I also had a chance to speak with Ken Chatterton, who heads the National Radio Club's Publication Center. Talking now with Ken Chatterton from the National Radio Club Publication Center. Ken, how you doing?
Oh, very well.
What do you think of the convention so far? It's been kind of interesting.
This has been a great convention.
Let me ask you about publication stuff. National Radio Club seems to have a lot of different products for DXers, and I was wondering, what are some of the more popular things that people are looking into?
Well, I think our more popular ones, of course, are the AM radio log and the FM log. We have four different antenna manuals now, one that is strictly for beverages and long wires, one for loops, and then our original antenna manuals, which include in Volume 1 the plans for the NRC 4-foot loop. There are a number of other plans in those books, too. They're very popular.
With the exception of, like, the log books and the different plans and things, what other kind of items are available that people really like?
Well, we have brochures printed in both or in English, in French, and in Spanish to send to the stations when you send in reception reports that explain the hobby so that station personnel that really don't know what you're asking for will get an idea. And we feel this does help the return rate. We've also got log sheets for you to log your receptions on. We have report forms, which also in French and Spanish in addition to English, which makes it much easier to send reports, especially if you don't speak the language that that station does. I guess those are the probably about the best-selling items to assist you in the pursuit of your hobby.
As I understand, I guess people can either send in a order prepaid or you can pay by MasterCard, Visa type of payments?
That's right. We have the mail order address at Mansville, New York, and then Mike will take credit card orders either by phone or by mail in Wisconsin.
Okay. On some of the items like the older publications, like, do you have any 50th anniversary books still available and stuff like that?
Yes, we do. We've got a few of the anniversary books yet. We're getting a little bit low on them, but we've still got some.
Okay. And is there anything else that that people find that's interesting through the Pub Center that they can purchase for their DX hobby?
Well, probably the reprints would be as much of interest as anything. We've got, probably 500 pages of reprints from past articles that have appeared in DX News. And these reprints cover almost any subject you can imagine.
Okay. And usually to place an order from the Pub Center, how long does it take you to turn an order around to somebody?
That can vary quite a little, depending on just how busy we are when the order catches us. But usually, we can turn an order around in less than 2 weeks.
Okay. Thanks very much, Ken.
Thank you.
I had an opportunity to speak with Jerry Starr after Jerry just got up that morning from a all-night DX session while at the convention. Talking with Jerry Starr, who just happened to ooze in from Youngstown. How you doing, Jerry?
In more ways than one, Fred.
Let me ask you, before we get into some of the convention stuff that's been going on, you're in radio and happen to keep an eye on a lot of the stuff that's going on, at least up in the Ohio area and around the country. Where do you think radio is progressing to in the 90s? Is it going to get back into more like what it was in the 60s, professional radio, or more automation, or what?
Well, I think you got to talk about AM and FM separately anymore. It's not just radio anymore. The division between AM and FM is getting wider and wider and wider. And I think, unfortunately, I don't especially care for the concept, but I think you're going to see more and more robot radio on AM, so to speak, satellite-fed, satellite-controlled
broadcasting on AM simply because of the economic factors involved. In a market where you have a number of AM and FM stations, the AM stations, for the most part, are having a real tough time financially. The FM has such a large share of the market. I think on FM you're going to see probably a return to more personality-oriented programming, at least as far as the popular music-type stations are. You're going to find less time and temperature, especially in the morning shows. I think you see it now with the morning zoos and everything. You see a lot more personality. People are now people once again, not just voices playing records on the radio. And I think that's healthy. I think that's what made radio what it was in the 60s and 70s when it was so much fun to listen to, and I think that's coming back.
I'm not quite sure.
With what the Federal Communications Commission has been doing is this deregulation and stuff. Do you think that's been good or bad for radio?
Well, there's a new FCC. It's just not the way it used to be, and I think some of the deregulation was necessary, but I think in some cases they went a little too far with it, and I think they really need to tighten some things up, especially on the technical regulations. There's a lot of things that they really should be looking at more closely than they are. They need to go out and do more than just check tower lights. That's the new FCC, that's their latest thing. They go out and fine people for not having their tower lights properly lit, which is important, but there are other things they need to look at too.
As a DXer, do you hear a lot of technical and operational faux pas on the air these days or not?
Well, you know, one of the very first things they deregulated was they took away the necessity to have your frequency checked by an outside source once a month. It used to be everybody had once a month they had to have a frequency checked by an outside frequency lab. And with the advent of the small, portable, inexpensive counters that most stations can afford, they said, well, okay, you can measure your own frequencies. And all you have to do is go up and down the broadcast band, especially the graveyard channels that have a lot of carriers on them, and you hear a lot of heterodynes on there. There are a lot of people who just aren't looking at their modulation monitors. And, in fact, they deregulated the point where you're no longer required to even have a deviation monitor anymore.
As far as, you know, the operational stuff, what about station IDs and that kind of stuff? That seems to have kind of gone by the wayside.
Yeah, you hear stations IDing at 10 minutes before the hour now. That's one of the new things is there are certain consultants that say it's more advantageous for you to run your legal ID at 10 minutes before the hour. Now, well, how they determine that was the time to do it, I don't know, but you hear people doing it, and technically you're not allowed to do that, but it doesn't appear that they're enforcing that in any way. And broadcasters, being what they are, if it's not enforced, they'll take advantage of it, and if it's not enforced, they'll keep doing it.
A lot of areas are also getting hit with fines and such for, like, emergency broadcast system. Do you think a lot of stations are backing off on the, quote-unquote, serving in the public interest?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's probably true. Not generally. Most broadcasters, especially who have been in a market for a long, long time, have developed a sense of community, which they feel it's important to serve the community. But then again, there are other broadcasters who essentially are in it to turn a profit. Of course, all of them are in it to turn a profit. If you don't make a profit, you can't continue to operate the radio station. Profit is not a dirty word. Profit is something you need to make to keep on the air. If you're not on the air, you can't serve anybody. But, yeah, they're, like anything else, there are community-minded, public-spirited broadcasters, and then there are some on the other side of the coin, too, unfortunately. It's always going to be that way, I'm sure.
From an operations standpoint, what do you think stations are going to have to do in the future to stay competitive and keep listeners?
Well, if I knew the answer to that, Fred, I'd put it in a bottle and sell it, and I'd have millions and millions and millions of dollars, and we could all go on vacation for the rest of our lives. I don't know. That's, you know, that's it's black magic. It really is. Mm-hmm. It's the science of figuring out, defining who your listeners are, or defining who you want to reach, and then defining what those listeners want to hear, and you know, there are stations that are successful and stations that aren't, and that's because it's all kind of a shot in the dark. Some mm-hmm. people are a little better shooting than others, but if there was a formula, we'd all be very, very rich.
As far as a DXer yourself, what are you listening to now on the dial? Are you hearing more stations, unusual stations, same stations as before? How's things going on the dial these days?
Well, tell you the truth, I haven't had a radio on for about a month or so because the noise level has been so high. We just had mm-hmm. a terrible amount of noise, and there's a lot of geomagnetic activity But you don't hear that anymore because virtually everybody that can operate 24 hours a day is. And satellite programming has made that easier to do. You no longer have to have somebody to work that midnight to 6 Sunday morning graveyard shift. You just plug it into the satellite and let it run now.
Mm-hmm.
So the bands are a lot more congested than they were just not too many years ago.
Comparing Youngstown to, say, some of the smaller towns around, you find out that's the case? The smaller towns are going more automated, more robot, while, say, Youngstown stays live?
Well, I think it's a matter of economics. I think they have to. Especially with the advent of FM, with FM coming into its own like it did, even in small markets, usually they have 3 or 4 good listenable signals from a larger market on FM. And to compete with that, you have to do whatever you need to do to put a professional-grade signal on the air as far as your programming goes. And, smaller stations can't afford to hire people to do that, so they do the next best thing, and that's go to satellite programming. But my personal opinion is satellite programming is pretty cold and impersonal, and even though a lot of companies have designed the programming to make it sound as local as possible, it can be localized with a number of local inserts and stuff, it still sounds like satellite programming to me, and I don't especially care for it. But it's here, and it's going to probably increase.
I was also able to catch up with one of the DX Audio Service members, Mike Lance, who was at the convention. Talking with Mike Lance from Miami. How you doing, Mike?
Fine. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. Let me ask you, how you like the convention so far?
Oh, I love it. I think it's the greatest thing in the world.
What do you, as far as a DXer, what do you think of radio these days, especially down in the Miami area? That's an area which I never get to get down to. So let me just kind of quiz you on your part of the country.
Okay.
What kind of things are you listening to down there? What kind of things do you hear?
Well, Miami has a lot of sports. It has a lot of shock radio talk shows. It has some music on WQAM. They do the Cool Gold Network, and Miami radio just isn't there.
Mm-hmm. Are you finding that you're listening now to more stations, out-of-town stations, and or is it kind of a mixed match between the AMs and the FMs?
Oh, most definitely. I find the AM and the FM stations in the South Florida area sound so much the same.
Mm-hmm. Is that typical for up and down the coast, or is that just in that area?
It's kind of typical up around there.
Hmm. Okay. As far as the your DXing and stuff, what kind of things you look for or listen for the most?
Well, I've been concentrating a lot on FM skip, and I've been concentrating a lot on new stations, and I also concentrate on a lot of the stations that I read about in the DX Audio Service to see if I can pick them up anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Do you, in Miami, do you hear any, like, the Cuban stations or anything out of the Caribbean at all?
Yeah, I hear a lot of Cuban stations, and, for example, on 700, I used to be able to pick up WLW. Not anymore. I pick up Radio Wonderful, JBC, on 700.
That's out of Jamaica?
Yeah, and they're also on 850, too.
Same programming?
Yeah.
Okay. What about the Radio Marti and such? Does that put a hamper on some of your DXing or not?
Oh, yeah. In fact, on 1180, Radio Marti is on that frequency along with Radio Tayuno.
Hmm. Okay. And what about some of the Cuban stations beaming back? Do you find that you have a lot of reception from Cuba, a lot of different channels, or is it primarily just like one network with several different channels?
Well, some of it is several different channels, and some of it is different stations from Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awful. It's getting bad.
Hmm.
Except at 1 o'clock in the morning, because the Cuban stations sign off now.
Oh.
1 o'clock in the morning to save power.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can pick up a lot more.
Mm-hmm. What do you like most about this convention?
The people, the radio stations are good up here, and The air is nice.
Are you looking forward to another convention in the future?
I certainly am. In fact, I hope we can have one in Miami one of these days.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Okay, Fred.
Have a nice day.
You too.
Talking with Martin, and you're from
New York City.
New York City.
That's right.
Okay. So what do you think of the convention so far?
I think it's great. This is my second NRC convention that I've attended. I was in Pittsburgh last year when John Malachy hosted it, and I like that very much, too.
Let me ask you about DXing in such a New York City. To me, New York City is so big with so many stations that it'd be hard to DX, is it?
Yes, the band is saturated from several different directions. Not only do we have New York City stations broadcasting, but Nassau and Suffolk counties on Long Island, Southern Connecticut and Westchester County in New York have stations coming in, and also New Jersey stations come in during the day also. So the band is pretty full. I would say that that's true also of FM.
Okay. What would you consider as your best catch?
My best catch that I actually verified was WFAA in Fort Worth, Dallas area. I have a beautiful QSL from them. That was my best one. And I also was able to pick up on air on 800 over CKLW in Windsor, Ontario. But CKLW comes in very well year in and year out. Yes.
Okay.
And the Bonaire station from the Netherlands Antilles was a real shocker to me. I got that in the wintertime on a Sony portable that was on battery power at the time. That was my best, also another best catch.
Being on the East Coast, do you ever have a chance of hearing European stations?
In the New York City area, that's tough, because we're really on sea level, and we have the Hudson Valley Mountains, the Catskills, to the north of us, and that's really tough. So you really need a good antenna for that.
Being in New York, did you ever have a chance to hear some of the different pirate stations that operated in that area?
Oh, yes. I could think of three stations. WHOT, which was on 1620, they were on for a long time. Then they moved to 91.5 on FM, and they actually shared time with a local station that is operated by the Board of Education, WNYE-FM, and they were on that frequency for a long time. It was a beautiful pirate, believe it or not, because they had professional jingles, and they air using what I would gather to be something called the loop. And then the FCC approached them and shut them down, but they were on for a very long time. And now the fellows who actually did that, I think I heard them, they were involved somewhere else, so I can't think of it. But the best one of all was the one from the ship Sarah, the good ship Sarah, which was on Long Island. They were off the coast of Long Island, and I was able to hear them on both AM and FM. If you don't know the story about that, they were also aborted by the FCC. And now the fellas who were operating that station are now operating legally on, what is it, WWCR shortwave.
Right.
And I have heard that program also, and they take phone calls via an 800 number. I spoke to them, too. And that is really an interesting history of New York pirate radio. And the signals were beautiful, just beautiful.
Where were the where was the ship actually anchored? Is it?
It was anchored off of Nassau County, on the Atlantic Ocean side, not in Long Island Sound side. And their boat that they had, I understood, had a Honduran registry. I read later on in one of the DX magazines that they had something like from the Cayman Islands, or if they were registered to some country that didn't have any kind of treaties with the United States, the Coast Guard would not have been able to board them so easily.
Very interesting. What about Southern DX? Do you hear anything from like South Carolina and Georgia and Imagine you probably get WSB.
WSB comes in very well. WBT Charlotte on 1110 comes in like a powerhouse into New York nights. The only problem with them is that on 1110, we have a station in Providence, Rhode Island, a country western station that comes in the early morning hours over WBT. And I called them, and it seems that they're getting their entire programming via satellite.
Okay. Where do you think radio's heading to in the future?
Well, we had the lecture yesterday concerning DAB, and we also see that the AM band is going to be extended to 1710. There doesn't seem to be any movement on that. I've only seen a few radios that now have the new dial scale in place. So it's a toss-up. The only regrets I have is that living in a place like New York, the band is so saturated that it's getting more and more difficult to DX now from a city dweller's point of view.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
We'll see you next year?
Yes, I hope so.
Okay, thanks.
Right.
We didn't have a chance to speak with Lori Boyer from New Zealand. However, Mike Nitter had a chance to pin him down and talk with him about a few things.
We're talking with Larry Boyer from New Zealand here. And my next question is, do you have, are most of your antennas, I would imagine, are pointed toward the United States, or do you like go toward the Asian continent itself, like maybe toward India or toward, you know, up in... maybe up toward Japan, up toward China? Do you get, or does that just come in naturally, or do you have to DX that to get those particular countries?
Well, the listening post that the branch of the New Zealand Radio DX League that I'm in, they have got pretty well an aerial farm. There's aerials pointing in all directions, varying from 1,000 to 2,000 feet. Myself at home, I have about 400 feet spread straight out behind me, which makes it a little to the east of north, which favors America rather than anything else.
Okay. Do you, if with no antenna hooked up, just a radio and maybe just a, you know, like a normal house type radio setup, would you get when you went across the dial, would you get other countries coming in? I mean, obviously Australia, but I mean, aside from them, would you be getting everything else around you?
Yeah, quite often on 774, you can't hear the Australian station for Fiji.
Really?
And there's other Fijian stations that quite often they're they'll come right through and then eventually crowd right out any other station around. The New Caledonia in 666 is particularly strong too.
Okay.
They've got a horrible habit of leaving their carrier on all night, which doesn't help things at all.
Oh, no. Do you get, when you're DXing toward the United States and Canada and Mexico for that region, are the West Coast stations more dominant than, say, the Midwest or the East Coast? Because I know when looking at the New Zealand DX Clubs magazines, the Australian Club magazines, that I noticed that there seems to be a mixed bag of it, and I'm just kind of curious if it does basically spread across the country. I mean, I know it's like Florida. You guys seem to get an awful lot of Florida.
I don't know why that happens, but it seems to be one of the predominant states. Whether it's something to do with the Gulf of Mexico and there's not so much land to pass over, I don't know. One of the strong signals, KSL in Salt Lake City, is quite good. As a matter of fact, I did have guests in my house from Salt Lake City earlier this year. I didn't say anything to them, but I just went and turned on the radio and said, "Well, Leo, there's KSL for you." They got a shock.
Well, I guess. Jeez. Now, I got to get my geography straight. Now, you guys are coming up onto your summer now.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
Now, is your best DX time like ours is in the winter? So it'd be your winter, our summer, and your worst time would be, or is there not really a, because of all that open water?
The best results for North American DX usually occur in late January and through February.
Okay. Which would be about, yeah, see now here we're at least around the upper Midwest, it's part of the last half of December, all of January, and part of February. So it's almost the same.
Yeah.
As far, you know, well, I'll be done then.
It was always thought there for years that the best Asian DX was probably midwinter, but it's since been proved that September seems to be about the best time now. Things have changed around. I remember years ago we used to get the European stations coming in February, March, then late August and September, around 6 a.m. in the morning, between 5 and 6. Then we were turning the dials one night at about 5:30 p.m. and we started getting Europeans coming in then, which no one had ever heard of. We didn't know what we were hearing, but then it came across very clear, Radio Nice. So that was obviously France. From there on in, people started doing a bit of DXing at night time after work and getting Europeans at certain times of the year.
Do you get, that was, I was just going to ask too, you do get some real decent European catches that come in down there.
Oh, yes, yes.
That's amazing. What about Africa, the north? Now, like here in this country, we basically just get the northwest part of Africa. We don't, at least I haven't seen lately, anybody getting, you know, the main body or the lower half of Africa that would ever come in here. Once in a while, somebody along the extreme east coast may get, like, something out of South Africa or something like that may come up, but most of that is basically short waves. Do you guys get a good, you know, bunch of that coming up too?
Northern part of Africa, yeah, we've heard one or two there. We don't get Africa really good, although, strange to say, about 2 years ago, all of a sudden, on 1386, 6 o'clock in the morning, in comes the Seychelles Islands. 10 kilowatts, just as loud as a local. And this lasted for a couple of weeks. The next year it was there for a few days, and we haven't heard it since. But South Africa itself is a pretty rare catch. Actually, years ago, as a guy that used to be in the NRC, Ken Mackey, who I class as one of the best DXs New Zealand ever had, he was listening at one post, and I was probably 8 to 10 miles away listening at my little post by the beach, and just after daylight we heard these real strange signals coming in. We couldn't work it out. Then we got talking together. We're hearing the same frequency, the same program on two stations. He heard another frequency and I heard a different frequency again. The only possible thing it could have been would be South Africa. So we wrote and they verified, they were more than happy to verify.
Right, parallel frequency, yeah, okay.
But the southern part of Africa is, it's just about impossible.
What about Central and South America? Does those?
Well, that is very strong. There's a lot of the guys where I live in Invercargill, and Paul Ormandy and Omaru, they really go for the Central and South American DX, and particular times of the year, March, they really seem to get into some pretty good stuff there. Unfortunately, the percentage of verifications from that area is not 100%.
Right, right. That's the same problem we got here. Same problem.
The let's talk about equipment. What kind of you'd mentioned you guys got a lot of beverages or some extreme long length wires. What about the radio gear? What's the most popular brand? You know, portables seem to be the big thing, or is it the tabletop type units, or
the one that's the most popular now on the communications receiver seems to be the Sony 6800W, which I use myself. There's five or six of us in Invercargill alone have got those, and we're pretty pleased with them. They're one I haven't seen or heard of many around in North America. But, well, this guy I mentioned before, Ken Mackey, he had one of the best sets to listen on and get stations that I've ever heard. And that was a 1936 Patterson. And it just seemed to have a magic touch and drag him in from anywhere.
Mm. That's been a design of the radio in that era. Jeez, that's amazing. Do you guys have easy access to getting, you know, like here we've got all these commercial outlets, too numerous to mention. As far as getting the radios, we've got, there's got to be at least half a dozen or a dozen places where you can get that equipment. Is that, is there local outlets to buy your equipment there, or do you have to, I know there's two places that I see popping up all the time in the Australian, DX Australia magazine, but do you guys have places to buy that equipment there?
We can get it. Usually you've got to get it through Auckland. If you're going into communications receivers, or a local radio shop will get it for you. But the league itself has a pretty good deal with a couple of firms in Auckland, and apart from the fact that they'll give us discount, when anyone buys a radio of that type and is not involved with DXing, they give them quite a lot of information in the DXing, free booklets and this sort of thing to try and encourage them.
Yeah, we've been trying to get Radio Shack to do that for us here, and they just won't see it. We've even gone through the Anarch group to try that, and it still doesn't work. We're still working on that problem, but yeah, it would be nice if they would hand out a packet of stuff along with the radio that they sell instead of us having people stumble across us. But I guess that's a whole other topic and a whole different other problem. We're talking today with Larry Boyer from New Zealand. And exactly where in New Zealand are you from?
Right at the tip of the South Island. There's another island, a fairly big island below us, but it only has a population of 600 or 700. It's mainly a fishing area and salmon farming there at present too. Population of about 50,000 people.
Ooh. Pretty good sized town.
Oh, yes. It's pretty well laid out, wide streets, crazy drivers. When I first started DXing, I was in Dunedin, which is 137 miles north. And I got to building myself an 8 by 12 shack to put at a beach, which meant on Friday nights I would get a push bike, put it on a train, travel 13 miles towards this particular shack, then I'd pick up a recharged battery and put that on the carrier of the bike. I already had a pack on my back with all my radio books in. A bit of food for the weekend. It was another 8 miles bike. I'd get to the shack for the weekend and do my listening. Unfortunately, coming home on Sunday, there's no trains run, so I had to bike 26 miles home. We used to do that. Eric McIntosh, who was also in the NRC, he thought nothing of getting on a push bike if there was something special anyone to hear. He used to go out to a place called Riverton, which is just round the coast from Invercargill, but it was 24 miles away. They also used to listen there in a place that they used to call the 6x3, which was actually about a 6x4 wooden box sitting on top of a sandhill or a sand dune with an aerial antenna running about 1,000 feet away from it, and they used to lie in this place side by side with the radio and listen. Another guy down there, Keith Robertson, he was on a farm and he had pretty good reception down there, but to improve it, he had an old trailer towed away up in the paddocks about a mile away from the house. He put his radio and his battery in a wheelbarrow and wheeled it up wherever he wanted to do some listening. So, you know, there was some guys down there that were pretty enthusiastic on DXE.
A lot of work went into getting that radio set up. Jeez. Are the beverages set up all the time then, or do you guys have to take them down every weekend when you're done, or are they permanent on these?
No, it's actually through an aluminium smelter down there. They bought up a lot of property, Comalco, which I don't know if you've heard of in the Northern Hemisphere, but it's a pretty big operation in Australia and New Zealand. They actually bought a sheep station that was there. It wasn't that big, you know, but a couple of thousand acres at least, something like that. They've got their factory set up there, and they, through contact with the New Zealand Radio DX League and the branch down there, have given us the use of the house that was on this station, which is a couple of miles away from any interference whatsoever. The boys have got together down there, and they've got the house immaculate. The upkeep is paid for by the smelter itself, provided that we do the labour for it. So they've got solar panels fitted and everything down there, and anyone that's a member goes down, and you do leave a subscription of a buck or a couple of bucks a night for the use of the facilities to help keep it going. As long as we treat them right, they'll treat us right.
Right. Well, that's a very good setup. Jeez, that ain't bad at all. On the car radios in the vehicles, are they like we have here, the AM, FM type combination radios?
Virtually every radio you buy down there now is AM, FM, even to the wee handheld ones.
Oh, okay. So they're not just AM only, or, you know, just like ours was for a long time. Okay. All right. The do you have, is there an interest in that country for shortwave?
Or yes. Shortwave's pretty strong down there.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. Well, in the DX League, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There's some pretty good catches heard from that area.
Basically the same coverage. I mean, you know, in other words, the Europeans, the North Africans and all that stuff, same basic areas as the AM?
Yeah, except that South Africa is a lot easier on shortwave.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you there, yes. They do come in pretty good here, too. That's right. Yes, that they do.
But the other areas there, likes of Madagascar, Angola, all that sort of lower part above South Africa, it's still very, very hard to hear out there.
I'll be darned. Even on the shortwave?
Yeah.
You'd thought you'd be able to pick that up. Well, that's interesting. Do you guys get, does Japan and more direct north come in?
Oh, yes. Japan's very strong.
They are. What about China? Beijing and Singapore and all that? That comes in pretty good, too.
Oh, yes.
Are they just off the top of your head, for a daytime band scan, like, what countries would come in on with just a regular radio? No fancy antennas hooked up pointing in one direction or another, but just a normal you were just to sit out in your car and turn on your radio, say at noon, what would be some of the...
This is on show what?
This would be on AM band.
On the AM band?
Yeah.
You'd only hear the New Zealand stations.
You would, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Winter time...
I was going to ask, in wintertime, would it be the same effect? See, like here now, during the summer, if we were to go sit outside right now and turn on a radio, we would hear some Central, South, and some Cubans would come up. Central and South America and Cuba would come up at night. Mm. During the day, of course, you obviously just get the, just the locals in there.
Yeah, we're much the same, and of course, okay. It depends on the length of the day. When you get to midwinter, it's quite often it's still dark well after 8 a.m. and it gets dark again around towards 4 in the afternoon.
Okay, same here.
And you can hear from just before that.
Hmm.
I have actually heard South Americans coming in at 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon in midwinter.
Ooh. Well, that's pretty good. Huh. Now, do you always use, what's your standard setup at your location for normal diction? Do you just, have a shorter length order that you use just to get a general feel of the thing before you hook into the bigger equipment to DX something, or do you just normally sit with your radio on the
floor? No, usually, most nights, if I get a bit of free time, I'll go right along the dial just to see what I can hear.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's one of those rare times where I got plenty of spare time, I'll get in and actually do a bit of shortwave listening.
Oh.
But I'm afraid that doesn't happen very often. Not as much as I'd like it to, anyway.
Get the feel of the dial then, as far as how the things feel like, and then just... with that same equipment, do you use that all the time? Or?
You've only got to go along the dial for a minute, and you know whether it's going to be a night, whether it's worth listening or not.
I wish we didn't have all 5,000 stations to put up with. That'd be a nice... How many stations could you... you were to sit down in one night, let's say from 8 o'clock at night till midnight during the winter, say a four-hour period, would you collect, say, 200 stations? Or, would each channel have a station on it?
It would. And that would change. Early in the evening, you would hear stations from Tasmania. Then it would move up, say, to New South Wales, then Queensland, then round the Pacific, and then getting in midwinter after 9 at night, you're quite likely to hear Japanese, Koreans. Pretty well all around there. Quite often Hawaii as well.
Oh.
Anything sort of around that Pacific basin.
Right.
At times.
Do the U.S. stations come in basically during a one particular time frame at night? In other words, like say after midnight, would the U.S. comes during the winter time, during your peak DX season, or are they there from dusk until dawn?
No, it's dusk. You listen around say just before dusk, and you can sort of feel them and know that they're going to start to come in, and you just go on from there on out.
Now, would they stay until morning, or
No. Okay. They might be in for a couple of hours. Actually, if you get a really good night, now this happened years ago at a prime listening location I was in, but you virtually started off about 9 o'clock at night, and you'd hear the East Coast opening up, and then each hour it changed, there'd be a different station come on the same frequency. If you sat on the same frequency, I'm sure you'd have picked up four different stations.
Just walking right across the country.
Yeah.
I'll be done.
I think one of the classic nights we had was there was six special broadcasts on one night between the NRC and the NNRC. It's going back quite a few years now. And We heard the whole six in New Zealand.
Wow.
And they were spread right across the country. I think one was in Millville, New Jersey. Another one was in Texas. They're spread right throughout the country. And
you all, got the you six got them all, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Isn't that something? I'm just amazed that you guys can pick up all the, you know, all the way across the whole country. Because looking at the reports, it's you know, like we talked before, Florida just seemed to be the dominant. And then the Midwest, the Missouri stations and that, you guys seen in Texas, it just, you know, you would just assume that it would be strictly those in, you know, California and that would be it, or Hawaii, you know. But, boy, you guys get them from all over the place. They just seem to make no difference where they're at.
Well, I have even heard stations coming through XERF down there. And, you know, I'm talking about stations of 1 kilowatt, something
right.
like that.
Right. Yeah, we've gotten, I know on stations here, I know there was a station in Texas that I believe it was either Chris Hansen or Chris Hambley over there in Australia. He had supposedly heard them. The station, he had mentioned that he was with DX Australia Club down there as well as the NRC. Well, the station guy knew about us, so he wrote the letter to us here at the headquarters and said, is this guy pulling my leg or did he actually hear us? And I said, I haven't known a guy to lie, so it must be, he must have really heard you people. And then we gave him some examples. And I had just gotten the New Zealand DX Times magazine, and I photographed for him, or Xeroxed for him the catches there on the beverage kit, whatever it was. And I said, and there happened to be one or two stations listed in that particular section on Texas, two stations that were heard. So I had Xeroxed that and sent it back to the station. And apparently he must have got his verification, because this guy just thought, and there were, I believe, a 1 kilowatt station. And they just couldn't believe that, no, there's no way they're going to, you know, we can't be heard 50 miles away. How can they hear us in Australia? And I can remember getting that letter, and then that station just, no, it just couldn't be done. So, but he had mentioned us, and then that's where the station apparently had gotten our address from somewhere and wrote to us here. And said, does this guy really hear us? But I'm just amazed that you guys, because you guys have heard states and stuff that I haven't even picked up, and we're right here in the center of the country.
That's right, yeah.
You know, and you guys have heard just, and it's just amazing what you guys can pick up down there. I'm just, unbelievable. Now, I take it most, all those catches are usually done on the beverages, though, right? I mean, it's
yeah.
because of the distance and that. Yeah. yeah, okay. That would make it obvious, isn't it?
Well, they are having quite good success down there with loop antennas. There's quite a few of them technically minded and making their own, and they're working out pretty successful.
Wow. Yeah, that would be a challenge to try to pick up, you know, these, you know, the same basic, you know, stations on a loop versus the beverage, because you would think the beverage would be the ultimate, you know, test of, you know, being able to pull in that stuff. But a loop would definitely, yeah, that would be interesting to see what the results would be on that. Now, do you guys, on the, one other question that comes to mind, would be on the, and our, up here now, of course, we get the northern lights. You guys obviously get the southern lights.
Yeah.
Do you guys get the same conditioning down there from the, when they come that far north? Do you guys see the band change drastically like we do here?
Anything can happen, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. We haven't had the aurora down there for quite a while until this winter. And
okay. We've had a few extreme ones here, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
We had it really strong this time.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, because basically you guys are
out for a while.
Yeah, basically you guys are too far north for it to really have an effect during a normal
yeah.
season of solar activity. But yeah, this winter there were some classic examples of some extremely strong ones that really kicked. Now, what about that strong storm in? I think it was May of this year that we had. I'm pretty sure it was May, where I know up here the northern lights were almost directly overhead in color, where normally they're only, you know, 20 degrees off the horizon.
Yeah.
And I would imagine an effect like that affects both poles equally, and I would assume that would have gotten down by you guys, and it does mix up the atmosphere quite a bit then.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Does it cancel, does it, in our case up here, we usually, it blocks out all the northern stations from coming down, and it really mixes up the south, where we may not hear Texas and Florida, but Central America may came up, you know, come up. And other times, it'll block those out, and yet, the further south we can get is Missouri or Indiana from Wisconsin here. Now, do you guys get the same effect as far as, you know, like all, you don't get the United States at all, but, you know, all the Europeans are coming in like crazy, or, you know.
No, it virtually blanks out the whole dial. We've got no stations to the south of us anyway.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So it's not going to help us that way. And it'd be, usually when we do get them, it's in the late evening, so it'd be the wrong time for Europeans or anything like that. So what it does really is virtually blots out the whole dial.
Makes it, yeah, pretty well useless.
Yeah.
Now, does it have the same effect on shortwave? Does it basically kill the whole band feed, or, you know, all the frequencies on shortwave, or does it seem to, or do you guys get some different catches that you normally wouldn't get?
Well, to be quite honest, I've never even had the shortwave on. I couldn't tell you that. Usually I'm outside looking at the lights.
Yeah, I know what you mean there. Yeah, that's true.
It's time now for the world-famous NRC quiz. I'm going to be your quiz master on this edition. The quiz was written by Paul Mount. I'm going to read you the questions. You give me the answer on paper, and then later on we'll give you the answers. Okay, question number one deals with new stations which are on the air. What is the city of license for each of these new stations? WKTR at 840. WOEQ at 1190. And KMCE at 650. Question number two deals with a who am I? Well, this station operates on 1530 kilohertz in the Great Lakes region. Their old call letters are representative of the part of the state that they're in. For 1 point, what is their present call letters, their city of license, and what is their old call letters that represent the thumb? How about stations in multiple frequencies? Well, WHOT in Camel, Ohio has moved to 1390. What are the call letters of the station that are now operating on 1330? Was it WFMJ, WYWR, WSRD, WWIR, or WIRE? Question number four is all about WNZK. Now, this station began operation on two frequencies this last year. Is that true or false? And if it is true, what is their daytime frequency, their nighttime frequency, their old city license, and their current city license? Question five. In these markets, a particular call letter has moved frequency. What is the old and new frequency? KLIF in Dallas. WLKW in Providence, Rhode Island. WICE in Providence. And WEVD, New York. Question number six. What are the two sets of call letters that have appeared on the frequency that KLIF vacated? Question seven. When CFJT 40 Erie eventually vacates 530 for 101.1 FM, what Canadian station is going to say ciao to their old frequency and move down there to 530? Question number eight. WTYO in Hamilton, New Jersey this year became WONZ. They now simulcast another New Jersey radio station. For 1 point each, what are the call letters, frequency, city of license of the station that they simulcast? A certain D.C. area station simulcasts WPGC AM from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m. to make up for some coverage problems. Question number 9 is, name the WPGC AM frequency and its city of license, and the call letters, frequency, and city of license of the station that simulcasts WPGC 12 hours a day. Question number 10. Which of the following call letters were never found at 1150 on the AM dial in Boston, Massachusetts? WHUE, WCOP, WITS, and WMEX. Some stations have recently changed their call letters to match their FM call signs. Question 11 deals with this. Give the last previous AM call letters, the AM frequency, and the AM city license for WNNK, WSSH, KRBE, WGKL, and finally WMDH. Question number 12. Lots of stations have morning zoos, but there are actually a WZOO and a WZOO-FM. For 1 point, what is the city license of WZOO and WZOO-FM? And by the way, where is KZOO? Question number 13. What U.S. president was in office when the FCC was created? Question number 14. What are the call letters, frequency, and city of license of the station which MTV gave away? Question number 15. What are the call letters of the Dallas station at 7:30, now widely heard at night? Was it KKDA, KDAA, KDDA, KFAA, or KFDA? Number 16 deals with call letter meanings. WLKW in Providence, Rhode Island. What does one of those letters stand for? How about CKLW? What do two of those letters stand for? And WSBC. All four letters stand for something. Number 17, what is the minimum and maximum power that a Class 2 station may operate with according to the FCC definition of a Class 2 station? Number 18, as of 8/12/91, are there more commercial AM or commercial FM stations on the air, including established stations currently dark? Question number 19. As of 8/12/91, are there more commercial AM or commercial FM stations licensed? This includes on the air, dark, and CPs. Question number 20. One AM station currently goes by the nickname of Yo 810. What are the call letters and the city of license of that station? And speaking of station slogans, question 21, where is QR77? Now let's get a little personal with question 22. Who's older, John S. Bowker or John D. Bowker? Question 23, who is the editor of DX News magazine? Question number 24, on November 1, 1991, which volume of DX News will be current? Finally, question 25. Name 5 NRC convention sites from 1980 to 1990. Well, there you have a good portion of the world-famous NRC quiz. We'll give you the answers a little bit later on. Go back and review your tape, listen to the questions, and see if you can get all 25 questions right. If you do, you get an attaboy from Paul Mount and a pat on the back from Mike Nitter. Hope to see you at the next National Radio Club convention, and then hopefully you can partake of the NRC quiz in person.